Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the political wins and losses for the president following his decision yesterday to support same-sex marriage. Steve Clements, the Washington editor-at-large for The Atlantic and editor-in-chief of Atlantic Live, joins us to discuss how this will affect Obama's chances in the swing states, 7 out of 9 of which have banned same-sex marriage. Then we'll go to Caracas, Venezuela, and speak with Virginia Lopez, who covers Latin America and Venezuela for the UK's Guardian and Sky TV. We will discuss the long absence of President Hugo Chavez, who is undergoing a third round of cancer treatment in Cuba, and the growing instability in a country beset by prison riots and one of the worst crime rates in the world, which may soon have a leadership vacuum without a stable succession that could result in a social explosion. Then finally, we'll speak about the Air Force's disgraceful handling of the F-22 scandal with the designer of two of the U.S.'s most successful warplanes, the F-16 and the A-10. Pierre Spray joins us to analyze what is wrong with the $500 million airplane that pilots refuse to fly because of problems with the oxygen supply and toxic poisoning that is debilitating them as well as the F-22's ground crew. Joining us now is Steve Clements, the Washington editor-at-large for The Atlantic and editor-in-chief of Atlantic Live. He's also senior fellow and founder of the American Security Program at the New America Foundation, and previously served as executive director of the Japan-America Society of Southern California, and co-founded with Chalmers Johnson the Japan Policy Research Institute, of which he is still director. Welcome to Background Briefing, Steve Clements.
Great to be with you, Ian.
And I must say I like the piece that you've written at the Atlantic site about the president's decision yesterday, in part prompted by Vice President Biden's Sunday announcement that now the president is on board with same-sex marriage. Tell me about the political fallout, because it seems to me that this has always been a struggle for the president, a kind of heart and head struggle, that he's always been in favor of gay marriage, but his head or his political advisors have been telling him he'll pay the price at the polls.
Well, you know, it's pretty clear, you know, that it's a divided issue in the country. And this week, North Carolina resoundingly rejected same-sex marriage as a track. They affirmed a constitutional amendment with a 61% vote that said marriage can be defined only as a relationship between a man and a woman. And of course, many people have raised this issue, but guess where the Democratic National Convention is going to be? It's going to be in North Carolina. So to a certain degree, the president has tried, and you know, he expressed this during his interview with ABC, that he had been subscribing to the belief that civil unions would give same-sex couples the same rights that married couples had, and then he came to a different opinion. So that's the jump. The jump is in language because it tweaks many people's self-identity and with religion and faith, and really gets into dangerous territory for him. That being said, as you read in my piece, I was convinced that to some degree the White House probably had pulled this and had, and I'm going to be writing a piece for tomorrow that's showing something that many people haven't looked at, is that attitudes in the African-American community and attitudes among independents have shifted dramatically. And this has not come out yet. Most people believe that African-Americans overwhelmingly oppose same-sex marriage. And that's the latest Wall Street Journal polling and the crosstab show that that's not true.
And of course, that's probably based upon what happened out here in California with Prop 8, which African Americans supported by 58%, and a lot of churches were beating the drum against gay marriage. And I imagine there's a concern because of the majority African American vote in North Carolina. But you're saying that there's been a tidal shift that's gone under the radar.
I believe so, but I don't think it's clear cut. Naturally, I talked to senior White House officials yesterday, and they basically confided that they don't know how the politics are going to cut. They did say that they did confide to me that the president had decided some months ago that he was going to make this statement, and he was going to probably make it in an interview like the one that he did yesterday and sometime before the convention. So that the only thing that really changed for the president was the issue of when, and that got nudged forward by Vice President Biden's comments on Sunday. And, you know, Joe Biden, you know, he's, I tell people, I said, you know, Obama does nothing impulsively. He's kind of like a Russian blue cat, like Chalmers Johnson used to have. Sometimes they love you, sometimes they stay away. But Biden's like a golden retriever. You know, he is just all heart, all emotion, and you know, he really loves the gay community in many ways. I've seen this directly, and I think he just made a very honest expression of where he was, and that honesty and emotional element of Biden's comments created a real quandary for the White House, which began walking Biden's comments back. And it would have looked ridiculous if 2 months from now Obama then came out all of a sudden that now he's for gay marriage and allowed Biden to just sort of sit out on his own.
Well, you mentioned in your piece, Steve Clements, that you were at the ceremony that Biden presided over, the swearing-in of a gay U.S. ambassador to New Zealand, David Huebner. And how Biden had lavishly praised David's husband, Dwayne McWane. So there's no question that Joe Biden's evolved.
Yeah, well, he was maybe evolved before many other folks at senior levels of administration, particularly at the president and vice president level. We have to remember, though, Dick Cheney did define a difference with President Bush on the issue of gay marriage. Dick Cheney, maybe in part informed by his daughter Mary Cheney being a lesbian, said he believed that this matter, you know, rested in the states, and that he opposed a constitutional amendment on marriage. So, you know, there was a moment of bravery, I think, in the Bush administration to some degree. But when you look at what Joe Biden, you know, put out there, and when I saw him, you know, David Huebner is a guy who was from Southern California. In fact, many of your listeners may remember him or know him. He's now our ambassador to New Zealand, and Joe Biden not only swore Ambassador Huebner in and lavished praise on his husband, but he walked up to Frank Kameny, who's a real legend in gay rights advocacy, just died this past year, and there's a whole section in the Smithsonian now of his letters that, you know, he walked up to this very crowded room of hundreds of people and said, now this is a real American hero. So, Joe Biden has been there, and when the Don't Ask, Don't Tell bill was signed, Joe Biden and Mike Mullen was there as well as President Obama, but Joe Biden really came down to meet everyone and connected. The president did as well, but this is a space that Joe Biden has sort of owned and the president has evolved into.
So again, I'm speaking with Steve Clements, the Washington editor-at-large for The Atlantic and editor-in-chief of Atlantic Live. What do you make, though, Steve, of a lot of the punditry that's sort of saying that the subtext for this decision was that the president's having a hard time getting Wall Street money? It's all going to Romney, so he's going after gay money. I mean, they literally have heard that expression, gay money.
I think it's pretty silly. I think the gay money probably would have found its way mostly to Obama, but there's a lot of gay money in Republican circles too. One of the, I think, important points of this, and I think it's, look, there's a very cynical political ploy that may be in play, but nonetheless, it's the way politics works. There is a theory that I have that President Obama, because of being president and having to compromise, as all presidents do when they sit behind an Oval Office desk and need to make compromises on climate change and environmentalism, and you know, he has not made all women's groups satisfied with some of what he was willing to negotiate away in healthcare, that you know, his star dimmed somewhat with some of his most active campaigners and organizers from the last time. And so by basically pledging himself to or endorsing gay marriage, he's picked a meta topic that swims along with these other topics that really matter to the very active progressive left. And to some degree, it forces Romney into a very uncomfortable position. If Romney doesn't come out and give a full-throated opposition to the president's position, then many evangelicals may find themselves very ambivalent and disappointed with Romney. And if he does move, in fact, closer to the evangelicals, he may then alienate independents and pragmatists that don't like to see the evangelical right having such a dominant place in the voice of what they hoped it would be, a guy that was going to fix the economy. So to some degree, Obama's position not only potentially gets people out on the street working for him and fighting for something, it potentially puts a really deep wedge inside the Republican circuit.
Well, I would think that it also, you know, Obama did get 1/4 of the evangelical vote in 2008, and I don't see why he shouldn't go after that vote, and I don't see why every time Obama talks about his own personal religion, I think he is very, very effective, and I don't understand why he allows the religious right to usurp religiosity. And of course they question his faith by these horrible canards that he's a Muslim and without a birth certificate,
right,
etc. So I think he should do more in that regard. But also I think it's also a prerequisite, surely, Steve Clements, to bring the young people back. And he mentioned that in his speech yesterday, that this is a generational thing. You know, the young kids like my daughter's generation, they're over this stuff. It's only old fossils like our generation.
But no, I think that's absolutely right, and I think his statement was very, very well crafted. I think it was sincere, and I think you know, it really did show that he finally came to the decision that civil unions didn't do it, and separate but equal didn't do it, and that's not something he could stand for or wanted to be a part of in the long run. And you know, I give him credit for it.
But as a political observer, Steve Clements, surely the front page of the New York Times has a very sobering graph of all of the states that have passed gay marriage amendments to ban gay marriage. They're all the swing states. I mean, almost without exception.
No, there's no doubt that this is a roll of the dice, and it could blow the wrong direction. On the other hand, I think it is the president mixing things about being about the economy. While the economy has been disappointing in the way it has come back, nonetheless, it hasn't exactly rolled completely back. We haven't gone back into recession. And so he's you know, as we've talked about before, he went after bin Laden, got him. It's a package of things. Voters are not single-voter people, but he is basically checking off a box for progressives and liberals whose enthusiasm for him has been, as Chalmers Johnson would say, easily restrained.
Well, but I think he's still yet to come up with the big argument. Why should we vote for him? You can't get that much mileage out of killing bin Laden or approving gay marriage. So you agree? Sorry, that was an anticlimax.
I totally agree. I think he's got to have more in the circuit. But yeah, I do think that what he did yesterday was historic, was important. My entire office at The Atlantic was watching that TV show at 3 o'clock on ABC when they aired it, and it had a feeling of being a pivotal shift to hear an incumbent president of the United States to say those words. And it's risky, and I think that Obama gets credit for taking the right risks. We'll have to see how many other Americans play this out, but I stand by my theory that it gives the left something to be for, at least in part, and it puts Romney in an uncomfortable position with his base.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Steve Clements.
My pleasure, Ian, anytime.
Again, I've been speaking with Steve Clements, the Washington editor-at-large for The Atlantic and editor-in-chief of Atlantic Live. He's also a senior fellow and founder of the New American Foundation's American Security Program and previously served as executive director of the Japan-American Society of Southern California and co-founded with Chalmers Johnson the Japan Policy Research Institute, of which he's still director. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll go to Caracas, Venezuela to get an update on Hugo Chavez's health and the prison riots going on in Venezuela. Breaks the machine. Everything's half a dream. How can it be? Everything's born in shame. It's not just me. Particle wave duality. How can we ever evolve when our gods are so primitive? They destroy our hope for peace, hope for love. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Virginia Lopez, a Caracas-based journalist who covers Latin America and Venezuela for The Guardian of the United Kingdom and Sky TV. Welcome to Background Briefing, Virginia Lopez.
Hi, Ian. How are you?
Well, and you've been taking some risks there covering La Plata prison, where there's been, for the last 11 days, there have been, well, it sounds almost like a war going on there. Tell us about what's happening.
Well, the first official report to come out said that close to 150 inmates had escaped via a tunnel. But then some official reports said that it had actually been close to 600 over a four-month period, partly due to the fact that there has been no custodian in this jail for at least 4 or 5 months. But the truth is that the jail is completely overcrowded. It has a capacity for about 250 men, and it is now housing close to 2,500. So you see, it's chaotic all over.
But my understanding is that the prisoners have been fighting the National Guard, and they're using heavy military-style weapons. So you spent time inside the prison doing a report for Sky TV. Tell us about what goes on there and how autonomous the prisoners are and what kind of weaponry they have.
There was a transformation inside the jails about 4 or 5 years ago that came about led by the inmates. It wasn't a government-led initiative. And basically what they did is that they turned jails into like these sort of leaner and meaner machines where all sorts of extortion and kidnappings take place from within, outside. The last time that there was a prison siege, like a big notorious one, was actually close to a year ago in El Rodeo. And one of the things that became evident from that and that I saw also when I went inside one of these jails for the Sky TV documentary is that inmates have complete control over the jail. They're heavily armed with war or weaponry that they buy from the National Guard. Completely overcrowded. It's on one hand, you know, a complete case of violation of human rights, and on the other, it's like I said, it's organized crime at its best, with complete impunity because partly they're already in jail. Nobody's going to go inside, and also because, like I said before, they run the jail.
So the reason we're talking about this, obviously I want to talk about President Chavez's health. It's been exactly 1 year since he went on national television and canceled a trip to Brazil and said that he had a debilitating pain in his knee. So it's been a year since Chavez has gone public, although he's been very secretive about it, and we'll talk about that in a bit. The reason I brought up the prison, Virginia Lopez, in Caracas is that my understanding is that that's the biggest problem for citizens of Venezuela, is that it's becoming an incredibly lawless state.
Yes, it's not. Yeah, there's more and more pockets where the state seems to have ceased functioning, and the citizens are moving into occupy the vacuum. And the jail is certainly one of these. They operate in almost like state-like structure. In fact, the prison leader they call the whole way that he operates the jail the government. So then actually whenever he's deposed in sort of jail lingo, they refer to it as a change in government. He extols taxes from the citizens, and which are, you know, from the inmates who are also called citizens in like local jail lingo. You're absolutely right. They operate like parallel states.
But there's a broader problem is that it seems that Hugo Chavez is in denial about how dangerous his country's become for ordinary citizens. I think, you know, he's obviously interested in revolutionary rhetoric and perhaps not dealing with the reality. And the long and the short of it is if you have this kind of anarchy inside the prisons, no succession to a man that looks like he's dying of cancer, isn't there a recipe here for a great deal of social unrest? If the prisons themselves are already hotbeds of anarchy, and at any point thousands of prisoners could walk off with their heavy weapons, I'm just getting a picture here of a country that could descend into violence.
Absolutely. You're completely right. It's quite grim. I mean, as it is, Venezuela is already one of the most dangerous countries in the world. Caracas is certainly, I think it's ranked number three as the most dangerous city in Latin America or the world. And we do live a complete state of fear. In a sort of almost typical way, most of the crimes get trailed back to somebody in the police or in the military. So yes, it's a complete recipe for disaster. And additionally, yes, you have a population of close to 40,000 men who are heavily armed with, like we said, you know, war-grade weaponry that could very easily walk out of the 33, 34 jails in the country. They actually have this system whereby they're interconnected, and they can reach agreements within each other, you know, with each other. And yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, it'd be dire to think of it. I think we're all in a bit of a denial because it'd just be disastrous.
But in terms of you as a Venezuelan citizen, Virginia Lopez, again, Caracas-based journalist who covers Latin America and Venezuela for The Guardian of the United Kingdom and Sky TV, in terms of threats to your personal security and citizens of Venezuela, what's the demographic that threatens you? Who are the people responsible for the highest crime rate in the world?
Well, there's obviously no, you know, official information coming out, and it's all sort of based on, like, you know, random reports that seep or that trickle. But usually the way that these things seem to operate is that they're quite skilled on one hand. So you know, there's the suspicion that they're ex-policemen or, currently policemen. And also, like I said earlier on, there's certainly an element of the National Guard selling off weapons to the inmates. And the jails operating, you know, the jails are quite porous. And there's been cases in which people have been kidnapped, and then when the relatives receive the ransom call, the call gets tracked to within one of these jails. So they're operating, you know, within and without, jail walls.
I see. But I take it that there's also a lot of kind of dumb random crime, you know, guys getting drunk and shooting each other. I mean,
There's been an escalation, but you're right. Yeah, usually most of the crime occurs within, you know, statistically speaking, from Thursday night till about Saturday night, Sunday morning, which is when, you know, people are off partying. A lot of these deaths, if not most of them, also occur in the poor neighborhoods among men between the ages of 17 and 24. That's the primary sector of the population that are the victims of crime. And of course, it's quite sad because President Chavez has always, you know, talked about the revolution being a process that would benefit the poor. And you're seeing that on one hand, they're the victims of this chaos, and they're the victims of violence and alcohol, really.
So let's talk again, Virginia Lopez, Caracas-based journalist who covers Latin America and Venezuela for The Guardian of the UK and Sky TV. It's been a year exactly to the day that Chavez went on Venezuelan state television to say he was canceling his trip to Brazil because of pain in his knee. And subsequent to that, he's gone to Cuba throughout most of 2011 for both chemotherapy and now for radiation treatment. And he was supposed to come back today, wasn't he, to Venezuela?
He's supposed to arrive today. We don't know the exact hour, but an ex-minister, Jesse Chacon, did go on TV earlier this morning saying that President Chavez had to extend his radiotherapy treatment. So, again, we're up in the air as to whether he might do a surprise return tonight, or whether, you know, he'll have to extend his stay in Cuba for health reasons.
But just a month ago, on April the 6th, during a mass in his home state of Barinas, Chavez teared up and discussed his struggle with cancer and said, "Christ, give me life, because I still have things to do for the people of this country. Do not take me yet." And the number of Venezuelan journalists, particularly Nelson Bacaranda, have suggested that he's terminally ill. Is that just speculation? I mean, it sounds to me, after all of this treatment, that something is deeply wrong here.
It's speculation in that the government hasn't come out with an official position, and it's speculation in that there have been no official medical record released, which is what makes this situation so debilitating nationwide, really, because, you know, we are all working on speculation and gossip. It's really quite annoying, not only as a journalist, but as a citizen, because, you know, the future of the country depends on somebody coming out clean and, you know, saying what it is he has and the amount of time that he has to live.
Well, he's just this week named 10 Venezuelans to a new Council of State, which is stipulated by the Constitution in terms of successors. And that suggests, at least, because there was a lot of concern that he had made no succession plans. It sounds like he's finally making some succession plans or putting a mechanism in place.
Yeah, there's been quite a bit of a cabinet shuffle since the beginning of the year. And the latest was this Council of State, which is, according to the Constitution, supposed to only serve to give advice to the government. But then the other thing that's going on right now is that Chavez has asked the National Assembly and has suggested that that Venezuela leave the Inter-American Commission for Human Rights. And this Council of State would also be working jointly in you know, advising whoever it is that is in charge of that move. So yeah, we are living in a very strange country at a very weird time. It's nobody quite knows what's going on. Everybody speculates. Everybody has a theory, and the government, you know, basically won't put us out of our misery, so to speak.
So tell me about the local reaction to Hugo Chavez's foreign policy. I mean, some of the worst dictators in the world are friends of Venezuela's leader, Hugo Chavez, and he has come to the aid of the Assad clan in Syria, who are murdering their own people in the most brutal and disgraceful way. And he's basically keeping that regime alive with shipments of oil, Chavez is. And, of course, he defends his friend Ahmadinejad when he was beating up his people and suppressing the Green Revolution a couple of years ago. So a lot of American leftists are in denial. They think he's a revolutionary hero like they believe Castro is as well. But how's it playing in Venezuela itself? Because I understand there's an expatriate Syrian and Lebanese community in both in Central and South America and in Venezuela.
Yes, the Syrian expat community in Venezuela, which is quite large and also quite powerful economically, protested heavily the declaration about 2 months ago of Venezuela's oil minister that he would continue to ship oil to Syria as long as Syria needed it. There were protests not only in Caracas, which is the capital, but also in Valencia, which is one of the largest cities here as well. Venezuelans are divided when it comes to Chavez. There's a staunch support of anything he does on one hand, and then there's also a staunch opposition about anything he does. But in this case, it was particularly telling that it was the Syrians themselves protesting against, you know, the support that was being shown to Assad, because, you know, clearly they're in disagreement.
So tell me then about the political opposition there. It's an election year, and the Venezuelan presidential elections are a month before the U.S. presidential elections. I think October the 7th, isn't it?
Yes.
And we don't even know whether Hugo Chavez is going to be alive, and he's certainly not campaigning, and he's not telling the Venezuelan people anything about his health. The only people who know about what's really happening are the Castro brothers and Cuban intelligence. But there is an opposition candidate that's been chosen, and my understanding is he's, in American terms, he's kind of he makes Al Gore and Mitt Romney look like they're charismatic.
It's difficult to compete against Chavez because Chavez has been, you know, the ultimate charismatic leader, I would say, even regionally. But having said that, Enrique Capriles has never lost an election. He's currently, or he was governor of Miranda, which is the most populous state in Venezuela. And this is a governorship that he won against Chavez's right-hand man at the moment. So he's a peculiar man, and I, you know, I have all the respect for him because he's been up to this point quite, you know, courageous in a lot of ways. Whenever he goes out in a campaign trail, he oftentimes gets, you know, attacked by Chavez supporters, but, you know, he's doing this sort of like home by home campaign where he's visiting, basically, you know, having face to face contact with people. So yes, like I said, you know, it's I wouldn't want to be in his place having to compete with Chavez. Chavez is, you know, we've seen him; he's a great showman. But also to Gabriel's credit, like I said, he keeps on surprising people. In the last primary election, the estimates were going to be that 1 million people were going to go out and vote, and the turnout was about 3,500,000 people, and he won the primaries with close to 3 million votes. So again, you know, he's a surprise. I don't know what else to say.
Well, but you say that he can't compete with Chavez in terms of charisma. But if you're in a country with no physical security for its citizens, it's a dangerous country, how is he campaigning?
Well, I think, you know, what his strategy up to this point has been to go at the smaller level and visit people, basically go, the whole sort of campaign is to go home by home, so one home at a time, and basically listen to what people are saying, and have this very sort of close face-to-face contact with as many people as he can.
So he's obviously, I mean, my understanding is that he's kind of awkward and kind of bumbling, and he's the antithesis of Chavez. Could that work with the people, perhaps people that are tired of the revolutionary comandante?
I wouldn't say he's so awkward, like I said, it's just that Chavez is so overwhelmingly popular and charismatic and has just that really special ability to engage with people that, you know, I think even Bill Clinton, it would be hard for him to compete against Chavez on a sort of charisma level. Enrique Capriles has, I think he's been improving, but again, it's, you know, Chavez has to compete with cancer. Rather than with Capriles, it seems at this point, you know.
Sure.
And Capriles is young. He's, you know, out there, you know, going all across the country, very much like, you know, Chavez would probably be doing if he weren't ill. But the truth is that he is ill, and it seems from his latest TV appearances that he's, you know, he's in quite a bit of pain. Again, this is me speculating because we don't have any official medical records.
Well, just in closing, Virginia Lopez. Tell us about the politics of the likely opposition leader who may well be the next president if he doesn't get elected by default. If Chavez dies, which is increasingly likely, does he represent the old guard? Because you know, there's nothing good to be said about the people who've run Venezuela for the last many decades until Chavez came along. The reason that Chavez is popular is that it was run by a kind of oligarchy that plundered the country, right?
Well, Capriles, as a governor, has been investing a lot of his energy in education. That seems to be sort of his, like, pilot, project. I think he hasn't been accused of terrible corruption charges, which seems to be one of the ills that affects Venezuela constantly. It is also, you know, currently, I think it's like the big elephant in the living room. Nobody wants to talk about it, but it's a huge problem that is also affecting us. It's hard to predict. You know, when Chavez came to power, you know, I think he enjoyed something like 70% of the popularity, and nobody would have thought that it was going to turn to be what it is these days. Venezuela has had the highest income from oil revenue in its history, we should look like Dubai, you know, walking the streets of Caracas, and it doesn't. It's complete chaos. There's been no investment in infrastructure in decades. So, I don't know. I don't want to say that Capriles is going to be excellent. I don't know. I don't have any guarantee of that. He's said of himself that he wants to be sort of like a Venezuelan version of Lula, meaning that he's going to blend sort of like a more responsible brand of socialism. He's also said he's not going to eliminate Chavez's misiones, which are that social programs that are so popular. But again, who knows? Who knows what happens once they get into power? And, you know, unfortunately, we do have a tradition of very presidentialist regimes that where there aren't very many checks and balances, and, you know, presidents tend to sort of take over all of the other powers.
But just in closing, though, can Chavez brand him as a part of the old discredited elite? He refers to them as the people who take their orders from Miami.
He's quite interesting. He and the political party that he belongs to are sort of this brand of like young Venezuelan men. So they're not necessarily tied to the old guard. They're sort of, I would say, like the third way. Mainly because they're young men, they don't have ties to the previous administration, and if they did, they've distanced themselves shortly after, you know, coming into government. And Enrique Capriles again is quite interesting. He's been in a political post in one way or another for the past maybe 12 years. Either because he was a mayor of a large municipality in Caracas, or now that he's governor. So he's had experience in power or in government. And like I said, you know, he belongs to this group of young men that have distanced themselves from either Chavismo or the other Adecope form of governance.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Virginia Lopez.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Virginia Lopez, a Caracas-based journalist who covers Latin America and Venezuela for The Guardian of the United Kingdom and Sky TV.
We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment talking with the designer of the A-10 and the F-16 about the disastrous F-22 Raptor.
Matilda, she take me money and run me away.
A tragic death has just occurred.
Looks like a case of just too many gold chains.
This plane is definitely crashing!
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Pierre Spray, who is a veteran high-tech defense weapons and systems designer, as well as a highly regarded producer of avant-garde jazz and other genre recordings. Pierre Spray was the primary designer of two Air Force warplanes, the F-16 fighter and the A-10 ground attack jet. He left the Pentagon in 1986 and went on to found Maple Shade Records. Welcome to Background Briefing, Pierre Spray.
Hello, Ian.
And the F-22 fighter has obviously been a long-standing scandal, but 60 Minutes did a piece with it on Sunday where they interviewed two of the pilots who had risked their careers to go public and tell it like it is. The Air Force has since not punished them because a congressman was giving them protection under the whistleblower statute. 60 Minutes also talked to you, didn't they, Pierre?
They did.
And what was the basis of the conversation?
They wanted some backup facts on how the oxygen generating system worked, and I provided them with a bunch of statistics on the rate of incidence of physiological problems, pilots presumably oxygen or oxygen-related.
In other words, the hypoxia, which is the symptoms that the pilots have been experiencing. But it's apparently worse than that. Ground mechanics are getting sick that work on the F-22 as well. So that suggests that there's more to this problem than even the 60 Minutes piece revealed.
The 60 Minutes pilots were the ones who really kind of opened the door by being quite frank about the extent of the problems. And basically, the way they describe the problems, these are not primarily oxygen problems. One way or another, the pilots are being made sick by something in the airplane. This is not to say that there aren't also oxygen system problems. An oxygen system failure actually killed Captain Haney in Alaska, and that was the cause of the grounding of the F-22 fleet. But the rate of overall problems, disorientation, loss of control of the pilots, is much, much higher than just oxygen problems alone. There are similar oxygen problems in the Navy's F-18, and they're running at a rate perhaps as low as 1/20th of the F-22 rate. This is an unprecedented rate for pilots to experience symptoms of confusion, disorientation, inability to fly, and so on. And it became very clear from what the two pilots on 60 Minutes were saying that they were describing symptoms that are persistent. This isn't just, you have inadequate oxygen and your brain doesn't function too well, and after you get on the ground and get a little breather, you're okay. They were talking about more than half the pilots having persistent cough, and apparently very similar problems with the ground maintenance guys. It's almost surely an indicator that something else noxious and poisonous, some kind of fumes in the airplane, either fumes from the engine or fumes from materials in the airplane, are literally poisoning these pilots. Now, the sad thing is that in the face of all this evidence, the airplane has been ungrounded. That is, it was very properly grounded after the death of Captain Haney. It was grounded for almost 5 months. And all of a sudden, the Air Force decided to put the airplane back in the air without having the slightest notion of what the problem was. They convened a major panel of scientific experts. The experts came up with no smoking gun, still had no idea of what was causing the problem. And the Air Force turned around and forced these pilots to fly the airplane again. That's what led to the 60 Minutes piece and the two pilots saying they didn't feel comfortable flying the airplane. Quite unprecedented kind of thing. But what this is really showing is that, once again, Air Force generals are placing hardware, money, and contractors ahead of the lives of pilots. And that's really what those two pilots were complaining about when they stepped forward to 60 Minutes. Needless to say, they didn't put it the way I did and would never do so.
Again, I'm speaking with Pierre Spray, who's a primary designer on two key Air Force warplanes, the F-16 fighter and the A-10 ground attack jet. Now, just separating out the oxygen problem from the poisoning problem that both affects F-22 pilots and ground crew. I mean, aircraft have been flying on oxygen, or pilots have been using oxygen since the 1930s. This is an old and tried and true technology. What's the problem here? Why? What's the shift that's taken place? You mentioned it's also the F-18 has a similar system,
right,
to the F-22. What happened there? Why did they switch from a tried and true method of providing oxygen to the pilots to whatever this new method is?
For the reason that lots of wonderful new technological gadgets are tried. The underlying reason, of course, is the new gadgets are more expensive and the contractors make more money. Of course, there are always other excuses forwarded when you have a tried and true technology replaced by something more complicated and more expensive. In this case, the excuse is always that the logisticians in the case of the Navy on board the carriers, in the case of the Air Force at air bases, they don't like dealing with liquid oxygen. You know, it's a pain in the butt. which is probably true, by the way. It is a pain in the butt. But, I mean, it's a pain in the butt we've been dealing with since the 30s, and we've had pretty reliable results. We've replaced it with a more expensive, less reliable system that yields at least four times the rate of problems with pilots, including fatalities. By the way, the Navy killed two pilots with this same oxygen-generating system on board the airplane. So they're, in a sense, guilty of the same thing as the Air Force.
So this is
that hasn't stopped anybody.
Right.
The obvious reaction to all of this is rip the oxygen-generating systems out of the airplane and go back to oxygen bottles. I mean, imagine if hospitals took this approach. You know, hospitals use liquid oxygen for patients with heart conditions and all that for at least an equally long time and with very thoroughly reliable results. Imagine if they decided, well, you know, oxygen is a pain in the butt, and we have this other thing that some famous medical device supplier is making, which is a little oxygen factory that we can install, and, well, it might kill four times as many patients as the old system does, but, you know, at least we don't have the pain in the butt of dealing with oxygen bottles. Imagine if hospitals took that approach.
Well, P.S. Bray, this is what they call, in terms of Pentagon procurement, gold plating, where
gold plating to the max.
Where contractors have, instead of using the Timex approach, they use the Rolex approach. So, and, you know, the long and the short of it is that these patriots that we have in the Congress, particularly on the Republican side, have just basically refused to cut any defense spending. They're throwing money at the Pentagon at a time when they're expecting people to take a hit, American people to take a hit on their Medicare and their Social Security. There's no advocates for anything but this kind of reckless profligacy. But what really burns me up is that all of these Congress people who are writing the checks to these contractors who are putting the lives of the pilots in jeopardy while they make profits, they're the ones that keep talking about how we stand up for our boys and girls in uniform and nothing's too good for them and all this garbage.
Right, exactly. The usual phony patriot story, which I'm sad is equally distributed between Democrats and Republicans.
Well, of course, that's the whole sad story of the military-industrial complex. It's a bipartisan boondoggle.
Right.
But do you think that given what happened on 60 Minutes, which has a pretty big listenership, and the fact that they didn't discipline these two pilots, and by the way, in the piece, the Air Force General in charge couldn't answer the problems. I mean, he said, yes, there's a problem, but yes, we've ungrounded the aircraft and the pilots are flying it, and we still don't know what's wrong.
Right, and he feels the risk is acceptable to pilots, you know, is what he said. And of course, it's not. It's unacceptable. It's ridiculous to be flying this airplane that we don't need in the first place and risking pilots.
Well, explain why we don't need it in the first place. And by the way, what is the unit cost on this aircraft?
This airplane is slowly coming to fulfill my prophecy of being the first $500 million fighter in history. But in actuality, right now, official numbers put it at $412 million per airplane. So we're not quite at $500 million, but with the fixes that are coming in and the further work that needs to be done to fix things that were wrong on the production line, it's guaranteed it will hit $500 million.
But there's a huge, let me just do a reality check here, P.S. Bray. Again, the designer of two key Air Force warplanes, the F-16 fighter and the A-10 ground attack jet. $500 million a copy, and also the enormous expense of training pilots. And yet the Air Force is prepared to put these aircraft at $500 million a pop in jeopardy, and the lives of their pilots. For what reason? Because they're just embarrassed that they don't know what's wrong with this plane? And
It goes a little deeper than that. Of course, it's a huge embarrassment for the Air Force. They've been defending this airplane. They howled when Secretary Gates decided to stick with the original program as proposed and end the production at 185 airplanes, which was the official program at the time. The Air Force howled. They wanted to keep on going for hundreds more. So, of course, they're saving themselves embarrassment, but most importantly, they're keeping the smooth flow of money going to Lockheed Martin because quite a number of them expect to have very handsome vice presidential jobs there when they retire.
So this is just, there's a word for this, you know, it's called corruption.
Exactly, exactly. And unfortunately, you know, our fighting men and women and sailors, soldiers, pilots are all the victims of corruption. They will be forced to use inadequate weapons, too expensive, too few of them in any future war, in order to satisfy the fact that high-ranking officers like to have good retirement jobs.
But again, I can't get over the fact that these are $500 million a copy, and it's cost the taxpayers millions to train these pilots. And they're trained to have the best reflexes, to be incredibly skillful and able to fly these high-tech platforms, and yet they can't fix the oxygen, which turns their brain into, you know, mush. I mean, it's, you know, what's the point of having all of that hardware and all of that skill in the pilot if you can't supply the oxygen that keeps the pilot alert? And then you've already lost a $500 million aircraft up in Alaska.
Right, exactly. Well, I mean, the sad thing is, in a larger sense, is you have a $500 million airplane that's nowhere near as good as earlier airplanes. You know, all this gold plating has resulted in an airplane of deficient maneuverability, grossly inadequate endurance, unable to outmaneuver, you know, a good 1980s fighter, and we're paying $500 million for this. And even worse, perhaps the worst single aspect, since you raised the question of these highly skilled pilots, and unfortunately, they're nowhere near as skilled as they need to be, because this airplane is so complicated that you can only fly it about 10 to 12 hours a month, which amounts to maybe ten times a month, and the pilots are getting hopelessly inadequate training because the airplane can't be flown often enough because it's a hangar queen, because they're constantly fixing complex electronics and particularly stealth coatings that constantly need maintenance. So the pilots, like the pilot who crashed and died in Alaska, he was one of the best sticks in the entire F-22 force. He was a really first-rate pilot. And in the accident report, they said he was fully qualified because he'd been getting between 8 and 10 hours a month of flying for the past 6 months. I can't tell you what an inadequate amount of flying that is. That's the kind of flying that's not adequate in the Polish or the Russian Air Force. You know, it's so little. And remember now, in combat, nothing counts more than the pilot. But you're talking about whether you win or lose, it's far more important to have a highly skilled pilot than to have the very latest airplane.
Yeah,
pilots
but
always dominate the outcome of combat.
Sure, but
here
if
we've bought a $500 million airplane that can't possibly train pilots adequately.
But the plane itself, is you've listed the deficiencies of the plane, but it's just surreal to think that at the end of the day, this highly skilled pilot is not getting enough oxygen to his brain.
Well, I mean, it may not be enough. It may be worse than not enough oxygen.
He's also getting poisoned, right?
He's being poisoned by the airplane. There's a very good chance that, in fact, what's really happening on this airplane that's causing this enormously higher rate of incidents of pilot, you know, malfunction incidents than even in the F-18 is not just oxygen deficiency, but a much larger portion of these incidents are almost certainly due to something that's present on the F-22 and not present on the F-18. Mind you, this is not proven, but quite likely, and that is the presence of stealth coatings.
Right, that's
the
F-18.
The F-18 is a non-stealth airplane. The F-22 is a stealth airplane. That means most of the skin of the airplane is composed of laminates, very similar to fiberglass, and glued together with extremely toxic glues. There have been problems even on the production line with the toxicity of these glues and workers getting sick. Now you have the same glue on an airplane, and in the presence of the heat of the engine, you can imagine how much of those fumes are being off-gassed due to a much warmer environment.
Well, just in closing, Pierre Spray, again, the primary designer of two key Air Force warplanes, the F-16 fighter and the A-10 ground attack jet. You mentioned the stealth technology itself being, not, you didn't say it's a hoax.
It is a hoax.
But
it is a hoax. Promoting it as being the secret to winning air combat is simply a hoax, because it does not make the airplane invisible. There are thousands of radars in the world, and radars currently being actively sold by the Russians that see right through all the stealth technology, and nobody is saying that in public.
And to maintain this stealth technology, people are being poisoned. It's very expensive. Right. And the long and the short of it is that if you fly a stealth plane like a B-2 through a rainstorm, doesn't the coating gets diminished?
Exactly, and that's exactly why half the maintenance is occupied with fixing the stealth, because every time you fly through a rainstorm or a dust storm, the coating gets disrupted. Then when you land, you have to reapply all these laminates and all these glues, and now you're exposed to fresh fumes again. That's exactly what I was saying.
And a lot of countries, like, for example, the Iranians would have, because the theory about an attack on Iran, you know, which, of course, we know that this has been discussed a lot, and there's a lot of speculation that Netanyahu has been pushing for some time to force the Americans into some kind of an attack, or they will attack Iran, and then we'll have to clean up their mess. That's one of the scenarios. My understanding, having talked to some people in the Pentagon at the assistant secretary level, they said that the reason that the Israelis want to get the Americans in on this war is that they don't have the bunker buster bombs that the U.S. has, and this special Air Force bunker buster bomb can only be carried by a B-2 bomber. So just let's go through that scenario. If after the election the U.S. and the Israelis attack Iran, you're saying that the Iranians could shoot down a B-2 bomber?
Sure. Sure. If they've bought, which I don't know, I'm not familiar with their present radar inventory, but if they've bought the standard Russian long wavelength radar, they'll know when B-2s are coming, and they can prepare for it. The B-2 is really slow, a really slow airplane. They can scramble fighters, and it would be a piece of cake to shoot down B-2s.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Pierre Spray.
Very good. I enjoyed it, Ian, as usual. We always have a lively conversation.
Well, yeah, albeit depressing for the taxpayers, for the pilots. It's just an absolute scandal. I thank you again for joining us.
Very good, Ian.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Again, I've been speaking with Pierre Spray, who's a veteran high-tech defense weapons and systems designer, as well as a highly regarded producer of avant-garde jazz and other genre recordings. Pierre Spray was the primary designer of two key Air Force warplanes, the F-16 fighter and the A-10 ground attack jet. He left the Pentagon in 1986 and went on to found Maple Shade Records.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Farhan Mohammed. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.